Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. You know, I used to get dressed up for these occasions, maybe sometimes even put on a jacket when we have a Nancy Pelosi or someone really significant on the program. But you know what? I'm dressed down here a little bit for Pittsburgh Week on the sports side and the fact that our friends at El Guapo, our new sponsor, gave me the T-shirt. Moeller's all upset that he didn't get the shirt yet.
But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm going to get one that's a little bigger with a better fit.
Figured it
for
out.
Me, but for all of our sponsors here, I had an incredible conversation this week with our friends from Taharka. They have a new flavor. It is called Black is Beautiful. Two of my favorite things, chocolate and stout. Oh, and they're opening it at the beer at Monumental. So I want to give them some love and some shout out as well. They're mixing together a new, you'll like this, Don, apple crisp pie, something, 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 and they want me to be the churn guy. So I'm going to go over there, and we're going to do that with our friends from Taharka, serving up social change one scoop at a time, as well as that delicious Black is Beautiful chocolate stout. Also, our friends at Fadley's are shipping crab cakes anywhere you are, one click away on the all-new BaltimorePositive.com. And, of course, Moeller and Gary Realty, the bow tie underneath Don Moeller on the new Baltimore Positive. Jeff Moeller, his son, will be joining us next week to talk real estate, realty, and all that stuff. Don, the new BaltimorePositive.com has, let's see here, you know, education, leadership, arts, music, sports, all of that stuff. But for our purposes this week, there is this little election going on, and I know you have reached into your bag of tricks to bring out all sorts of huge guests here on the eve of the election. We'll be chatting with former Governor Martin O'Malley. I know Congressman John Sarbanes is going to join us, but also many, many others. So let's go through your Rolodex here, because we're going to have a great, great week here.
Well, what my good buddy, the former Congresswoman from the 4th District, I only half joking as we welcome former Congresswoman Donna Edwards, that I think she must be up. I see her when I wake up with my coffee with Joe and Mika at 6 a.m. And I see her when I fall asleep at night in my bed on the 11th hour with Brian Williams. Congresswoman, when do you sleep in the midst of the 11th hour and Joe and Mika in the morning? When do you get a nap or two?
Well, it's such a good question, and I'm actually not even going to share it. You know, it's embarrassing. You know, because even when I'm not on, I'm watching too. So, and listening. But you know, sleep these days, I think there are a lot of us who are sleep deprived because of the times, because of the circumstances. And I'm planning to sleep a long sleep on about November 7th or 8th when all the ballots are counted.
My goodness.
Expect that to be done November 7th? I mean, if you could tell me right now that next Sunday morning I could get up and go over to State Fair for chicken and waffles and have the kind of result we're looking for here, that I would feel very good about that. I'm not feeling like – I'm a little more stressed than that.
I'm pretty stressed too, because I think that – you know, one of the things that Democrats have learned is that it's important to turn out every vote and to, you know, as Joe Biden says, to, you know, run through the tape. And so I hope that people take that message. But I guess the reason I said, you know, November 7th or 8th, or it could be 9th, 10th or 11th, I don't know. The point is, we're going to have to be really patient with this election. It's an election season, not an election day. And really just, you know, be patient as all the votes are counted. I mean, I know I want my vote counted.
Well, Donna, none of us have ever seen anything like this. And we're going to do a deep dive with you here in a couple of minutes. And actually, one of your colleagues, Mike Barnicle, a few minutes ago when I was grabbing my coffee, made a comment that I want you to build upon, because he really captured some thoughts that I'm having. But I'm going to test you a little bit. You vindicated me one morning with our good friend Kevin Kamenetz. Kevin used to, he was brutal on my eating habits, to say the least. And you and the former county executive and I had breakfast at the Double T Diner on Route 40. And as one, he would say, "Go ahead, Donna, you order first." And a woman after my own heart, do you remember what meat you ordered that morning? Because I do, and I was so vindicated.
Well, I'm guessing if I ordered a meat at a diner, it was probably liver.
No, it was close. You ordered scrapple.
Oh,
okay.
Threw his hands in
liver,
the air.
She did.
You know.
Oh, come on. He said,
liver,
come on,
scrapple.
Congresswoman.
Oh. I thought, It's all this, it's all, you know, sort of the same family of food that nobody eats but me.
That's what he said. He said, I didn't think anybody in the world but Don ate scrapple. He said, so I guess I've been disproved. So thank you for vindicating me. Donna, before we get into the election, give folks a sense who know you a little bit, not a little bit, a lot from MSNBC, but give them a sense of your background growing up and who that little girl that was 8 or 9 years old and your moms and dads and aunts and uncles, how that formed who you are today. We always like to learn a little bit about how folks became who they are.
Well, I really think the thing that really built my foundation, obviously my family, my mom and dad. My dad was 30 years in the United States Air Force. My mother, obviously, she served too because the family served. We lived in every single region of the country when I was growing up. I went to 14 different schools over the course of my my education, my sort of pre-K to 12 education. And that taught me a lot about showing up in a room and meeting strangers and talking with them and finding commonalities in order to fit in. And when I think about my upbringing, so much of that was not just about the different regions of the country and the strengths that we bring and how vast our country is, but also traveling internationally gave me an appreciation, even as a young child, that there's a rest of the world out there and we're not just, you know, in our own American bubble or our own state bubble. And I think that that kind of foundation really allowed me to build on, you know, the rest of my life. I had a varied career. I came out of Wake Forest University, and I'm a Demon Deacon through and through.
I partied with the Wake Forest Pep Band back in 86 at the Capitol Center. I sat, well, Muggsy was playing there, right? So,
right.
You know, so there's a Baltimore thing going on. They were hardy people down at Wake Forest. That's all I'm going to say. You know, that and Michael McCrary. So, yes.
That's well, right. We're small.
I want to stop you. I want you to pause for a second when you said Wake Forest. Because getting ready for the show, I was reading some biographical clips. And one of the things that caught my attention, because it took me back to my good buddy and one of my dearest friends, Wayne Curry, really the second person I ever met at Western Maryland College. We became great buddies. I always kidded him. He became president of the freshman class at Western Maryland. I told him when he became big shot county executive, because I was his campaign manager, I used to kid him. But and Wayne gone much too soon. But Wayne was one of only at that time 5 or 6 African Americans at Western Maryland. I saw that you were one of 6 African-American females at Wake Forest. Donna, talk to our listeners about that experience, because that's a bit of a trailblazer in the South.
Well, I guess it is. I mean, one of the challenges that Wake Forest had was Southern School trying to be a more national university and, you know, recruiting students. And of course, in this day and age, and even back then, I graduated in 1980. I arrived in the year of our bicentennial, 1976. And it was a challenging environment, to be sure. But I made friends for life, and they, you know, spanned, you know, sort of race and geography. But there were some things that happened on campus there that are reminding me of what's going on today around race. There used to be, you know, a group of fraternity guys who would march around the quad in Confederate uniforms and carrying the Confederate flag. And I was with a group of students and we launched a major protest against that to end that practice. And so those were the times, but it still meant that I could survive and be a success on that campus. Also on campus, I ended up being a resident advisor for a group of freshman women. And this was something that Wake Forest wasn't in the habit of making Black women resident advisors. It was just something that wasn't done. And those young women, I helped to nurture them and, you know, help them adjust to college. And some of those, I call them young women now because they were younger than me, but some of those women today are people that I continue to keep in touch with. They remember those days fondly. So it was overall a really great experience at the university. And today, of all things, I'm a trustee of Wake Forest University.
Wow. Well, that's what a journey, right? From one of six African-American women to advisor, to congresswoman, MSNBC contributor, and now a trustee at the college. That then really takes me to Barnicle's point this morning, congresswoman. And this, he made the point. Actually, my wife was still under the covers, and I was shaving, and I said to her, that's what I've been saying. Mike Barnicle said this morning that what really is on the ballot next Tuesday is who we are as a nation. And it sounds like such hyperbole, but is it?
No, I think it's really true. I think if you look around the world, democracies are under threat around the world. And we can't ignore that. I mean, we've seen it, you know, in far places from, you know, Belarus to the African continent, and here in the United States. And I always think of our little republic, the republic that could be, as one that is very fragile, and our institutions are fragile. And we've seen that over this last 4 years, our institutions, whether it's the legislative body and certainly the Supreme Court and the executive, are being tested. And we as Americans are being tested. And we can't fail that test. We have to pass. That is one test that we have to pass. And that test is going to be on the ballot, whether we want to preserve this experiment that we've come to know or whether we want to throw it away.
Congresswoman, for you watching what's happened, you know, since you left the Hill and obviously commenting on it on a daily basis, but for our audience here, I guess the level of frustration and where we are on Tuesday, and as hopefully you said, wishful thinking's next week and we have this solved, but a lot of these battles in South Carolina and Kentucky that would change what's going on and where the log jam is. This is a really significant week above and beyond Biden-Trump at many, many local levels as we look around the country. That's not the only race we're going to be following on Tuesday night.
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, in between my days at Wake Forest and entering into the Congress, I spent a couple of decades in the nonprofit sector. Both in philanthropy and in advocacy, really working on civics and civic participation and democratic institution building. And I think one of the things that I learned from that is the importance of voting and teaching people to vote up and down the ballot. That, your local races, your congressional races, the Senate races have everything to do with preserving our democracy as the presidency. And I think that if you look at races, whether it's in South Carolina challenging Jamie Harrison challenging Lindsey Graham, or in Kentucky, Amy McGrath challenging Mitch McConnell, but there are a lot of other seats in Iowa and Arizona, Colorado and North Carolina that are going to determine whether we have a Senate that is going to cooperate with who I believe is going to be a President Joe Biden and a Democratic House, so that we can right this ship. And we have to right the ship, I think, by beginning in 2021 with a set of reforms that are about democracy and about our institutions that are going to put us on a pathway to recovering our economy and rebuilding our democracy.
Well, Donna, you mentioned put us back on the path of democracy, to be bold, assuming that the vice president wins. If the Democrats can be bold and do some things. We have Congressman John Sarbanes coming on in a little while. And, of course, as you know, the speaker, you all have talked about it a lot on the air, as the first bill introduced in the last Congress was H.R. 1 by Congressman Sarbanes, which is a sweeping campaign finance reform bill. And when you take the pieces out of that legislation and you talk to men and women on the street, they almost universally agree with everything in that bill. And one of the things that just continues to perplex me is that on the major issues of the day, whether it be guns, whether it be climate change,
abortion, you, throw that in there.
Yes, even women's right to choose, go right down the list. The overwhelming percentage of the American people, healthcare certainly, how did I skip healthcare, agree with the Democrats. Now, and again, I guess the other point is, I was talking to a young couple last night. They have two children. They're both self-employed. One of their children has a pre-existing condition. And they said to me, we are really, really worried about Tuesday because health care for our family is on the ballot. How did we get here, Congresswoman, where Congress can't do anything? Hundreds of bills sit on Mitch McConnell's desk. The will of the American people is ignored, and everybody just throws their hands up. You were there. What happened?
Well, I mean, I don't think that this is something that happened in the last 3 or 4 years or something that even happened in the last decade. It's happened over several decades, really, since Watergate, when major reforms to our campaign finance system went into place after Watergate. They were called the post-Watergate reforms. And those went into place, and for a little bit of time, it helped at least to make transparent the amount of money that was in the system, where it was coming from, who it was coming from. And then fast forward, something that has really stuck under my craw, which was the Supreme Court in its decision of Citizens United. And in that decision, what the court did was they said, now corporations, open up your purse and you can spend unlimited amounts of money on campaigns. And what we've seen is an exponential increase in the last decade of spending on campaigns, of dark money in campaigns, ads that are run on television and digitally, and you don't know who they come from, and they have these weird names like Save America, and it turns out that, you know, it's money that's from every bad corporation that you can, bad actor corporation that you can think. And I don't think the corporations are people. And I don't think the corporations should have the ability to play the outsized role that they do in politics. And so that's why I very strongly support HR1. In fact, one of the provisions in HR1 is to consider a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. That was something that I was the champion in. I think I introduced the first constitutional amendment in the Congress, and now it has widespread support. These kind of structural changes are important to get our democracy back on track, to get the money out of politics so that money doesn't drive the conversation. I feel for that family with a child with pre-existing conditions. There are 130 some million Americans who have pre-existing conditions. And now add on to that, everybody with COVID, all 8 million plus of people with COVID are now going to be considered people with pre-existing conditions. So we just added another 8 million and counting onto those roles. We are in a really dangerous circumstance. And one thing, let me just say this. If a new Congress comes in with a new president, the Senate and the House, even if the Supreme Court makes its decision on the case in the court to overturn, to repeal the Affordable Care Act, Congress can act between now and the time that decision is made to fix the problems, to make changes in the law so that all of us with pre-existing conditions will not have to worry about that.
No, you've just laid out really an entire agenda. Since you touched on Citizens United, and since you touched on the Supreme Court, I mean, you're You're an unabashed progressive. You've never apologized for being a progressive. You're proud of it. What should the vice president, and we're going to get at some point, we've got to have you talk about where you think the race is going to land. But the vice president on 60 Minutes was pretty clear. He laid out what appeared to be a rational plan of having a bipartisan commission take a look at the federal judiciary and make some recommendations to strengthen the role of the judiciary. What do you think the United States Congress should do about the Supreme Court, given what has happened over the past few years with Merrick Garland and others, and what most of us think is unconscionable, filling a seat in the Supreme Court after millions of people had already voted, not even might vote 8 or 9 months like President Obama was talking about, but literally millions of people had already voted. What do you think Congress should do about the Supreme Court and the judiciary moving forward?
Well, I support the former Vice President Biden's plan to take a wholesale review, not just of the Supreme Court, but the entire Article III branch, the federal judiciary, from the district courts that have such an influence on our everyday lives to the appellate courts to the Supreme Court. And the reason is because it's gotten out of whack. I mean, keep in mind that President Obama had some over 200 judges awaiting to be added to the courts, from the district courts all the way to the, and then finally we know in the Supreme Court, and Mitch McConnell blocked those. President Trump comes in and a couple of hundred appointments have been made in this short period of time. And that was over Obama's 8 years. We're talking about 3.5 years, hundreds of appointments to people who were really not qualified, that the ABA determined was not qualified. It's interesting to me that when Judge Amy Coney Barrett was nominated, Republicans were going on and on and on about how the ABA, the American Bar Association, had rated her qualified for the Supreme Court. But then when other candidates for federal district court and the circuit courts came up, the ABA rated some of those people not qualified. And you know what? Mitch McConnell and his Republicans in the Senate ran them through anyway. And so I really do agree that we have to take a wholesale look at this and, you know, get our constitutional scholars in who span the spectrum so that we can make a rational, pragmatic decision about what it is that we need to do with the court, and if that includes expanding the United States Supreme Court. That's not set in stone. That is something that's left to the legislature, and I think that we ought to consider it given the circumstance that we're in.
Well, Congresswoman, I am so glad that you made the one point you did about President Obama's appointments. I hope you will continue to make that point on the air, because I don't hear it nearly enough. Because I go back to, again, as someone said, Trump no longer uses a dog whistle, he uses a foghorn. And he goes out in rally after rally basically saying, and President Obama, he was so darn lazy, meaning the black man was lazy. We know what that means. The black man was lazy. He didn't even try to fill judicial appointments. And as you point out, yes, he did. There were 200 sitting there that Mitch wouldn't take out of his drawer, and those are the 200 that you've filled. And nobody challenges him. He gets away with this stuff all of the time, and it's maddening.
Well, I have to tell you, I mean, to be perfectly honest, even as somebody who's now a commentator and analyst of politics and of the body that I served in, and certainly of the White House, it's actually tough to pick and choose among the many things that the president exaggerates and flat out lies about, to choose that thing to talk about on any given day. And literally in any given day, there are dozens of lies that the president tells, that his administration and surrogates tell. And it's tough to choose from a list because all of them are so important, not the least of which are the damaging lies that are being told about COVID-19 and its impact on all of our communities. And the latest count I looked at, we're almost at 229,000 Americans who died.
Yeah, it's remarkable. For those of you just tuning in, we are with former 4th District Congresswoman Donna Edwards from the state of Maryland, a frequent contributor to MSNBC. Well, go ahead.
Don't forget the Washington Post. Oh,
I see Post Opinions up on her Twitter. Absolutely.
And well published in the Washington Post. Absolutely. Absolutely. A must read. Donna, here's what everybody's waiting to hear. We're I literally, because I'm obsessed at this point, my friends are actually worried about me. My children are worried about me. I'm obsessed with what happens next Tuesday. I play with my electoral map every morning. If I don't come up with a good number, my wife doesn't even want me to tell her because it makes her crazy to think this might not go the right way. You've been around. You've done this a long time. Are you able to go to 10,000 feet and not let your emotions take over and give us an objective view of what you think is going to happen on Tuesday?
Well, what I will say is that I do think that the polling this time in 2020 compared with 2016 is so much better, especially the state polls. I think where the polling failed in 2016 is not a really consistent and deep dive in these state polls that, as we know, are a much stronger predictor of what will happen on election day. That said, in 2016, I was on the road almost every single week for Hillary Clinton in Wisconsin, in Michigan, in New Hampshire, in North Carolina, Florida. Those are just some of the states that I remember. I also remember that the last week being the week when the James Comey statement was made and the impact that that had on the electorate. I could feel it when I was out there.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, did you know she was in trouble?
I could feel the change in the atmosphere after that Comey statement. It was palpable. In fact, I think I remember I was in Pennsylvania when that happened, and everyone was talking about it. I then went up to New Hampshire, same thing, and down to Florida. And so there was a very visible impact. I think it was one of the most unfair things that ever happened. And keep in mind,
in the history of our country, in retrospect, and about emails and whatnot, when you certainly consider that the Billy Bush tape happened, you know, 2 weeks before that, right? Like, so reeling from that, I thought there's no woman who's ever going to vote for this guy. That's what I thought 4 years ago today.
Yeah, I mean, you and me both. But I will say that that had a huge impact. And we are only now beginning to unpack and understand the impact that the Russians had on the election. And so even with that, it was still within 77,000, 78,000 votes in, you know, three states that we've come to know, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. And so we know now to pay attention to that electoral map. And so I wake up every day looking at new polls, trying to figure out, you know, new configurations. And I have to say, I mean, I do pay attention to Steve Kornacki on MSNBC and his big board, because I think it's important for us to understand what could happen. And I think that there is still every possibility. Some of these states are just outside the margin of error, some of them within the margin of error. This is going to be a close election, which is why the imperative of people just, you know, making sure, and they will, making sure that their votes are cast, and then us paying close attention to these states as they count the ballots. And look, Joe Biden is a different candidate. I've known Joe Biden for more than 30 years when I worked on the Violence Against Women Act and worked really closely with him and his team. I know how he works when he was in the White House as vice president. I occasionally would meet with him. I actually traveled with him on, I think, one of his first trips as vice president. down to give the commencement speech at Wake Forest University in place of Tim Russert, who had recently passed. So I've spent a little time with the former vice president. We don't agree on everything, but you know what? I'm not voting for somebody I agree with on everything. I'm voting for somebody who can lead the nation. And I think it's going to be, I think it's going to be a tight one.
Well, let
me, or it's going to be a blowout.
Let me just say this.
Well, I like that second choice.
You mentioned the word royalty around here, Kornacki. I mean, listen, Mueller can get you. We can get Nancy Pelosi. We can get anybody. He's afraid of. He so admires Kornacki. Like, if you could just let Steve know when this is all over with, when he can breathe. That Mueller just wants to spend 20 minutes with him the way I want to with, like, Bono or Mick Jagger.
I do. I love the big board, and I'm fascinated by it. 10,000 feet again. Take the emotion out of it for us. Is the shift in Texas real? And I ask that with this backdrop. I saw an article yesterday, Congresswoman, that said – already in Texas, and this number, I had to read it twice because I thought, well, that's an amazing number, said that 2 million people that have already voted in Texas are people who did not vote in 2016. That number, it just blew me away. I go back to Beto almost beating Ted Cruz, coming within a couple of points. And I'm thinking to myself, I've been skeptical. So I'm going to ask you, is the shift in Texas and then I guess subsequently Georgia, are those two shifts real?
I think that they're real because if you look at the demographics have been trending towards Democrats, a younger electorate, a blacker and browner electorate, both in Georgia and in Texas. Whether it's enough to get over the top, I guess we're going to have to wait for that, but it is real. And you could see it in Beto's race. And those 2 million voters, what you see around the country, in fact, not just in Texas, is that while Republicans have done a really good job of getting new voter registrations because they've been more aggressive because of COVID, I think Democratic voter registration efforts have been hampered. But the new voters who are coming in are the latent voters, are the low propensity voters, are the sometimey voters. And those are the hardest to get. And, you know, when you get them, they're yours. And so I do feel that it is a demographic shift that leans heavily in favor of Democrats.
We really appreciate your time. We know you give so much of it to TV. We wake up with Royal Farms coffee with you guys sometimes. And Mueller will be – I don't know when Don's going to sleep. And we're all of us friends and family are all kumbayaing around Don here and hoping for a good result. Always a pleasure to see your work and really an admirer from afar. It was wonderful to wake up, see you on the docket today, spending some time with us. We appreciate it.
Hey, Nestor, before we let the Congresswoman run, we've got to put her – on the spot. She said, could be close, could be a blowout. Come on now. If you had to put $1,000 down, what does it look like when the electoral vote is actually counted?
You know, I hate to do this. I see Joe Biden somewhere. I see Joe Biden as president-elect and Kamala Harris as MVP, Madam Vice President. And I see that in the 280 to 290 range in the Electoral College.
Well, let me tell you, Nestor, this was not prepared. This is my spreadsheet.
Don Kornacki, right
at
here.
The very top. Positive. My prediction is 280 to 258 with all of us.
Oh, my gosh.
280 to 258 with all of us holding our breath for the count in Pennsylvania.
Great minds think alike. This is
Scrapple and 280. What can I say now?
Right. You're making me hungry. I gotta go.
And Post Opinions. You can find her out on Twitter at MSNBC, NBC News, and Post Opinions. Donna F. Edwards, of course, with the blue check mark out on Twitter. On behalf of all of our Baltimore Positive family, all of our sponsors and Fadley's and State Fair, I'm wearing my El Guapo shirt. Didn't even make me the logo. It doesn't even look like Don Mueller. It looks like Bruzzy over there in Gatesville. and our friends at Taharka with the new Black is Beautiful flavors, and eggnog coming soon. We are WNST.net, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. We never stop talking elections and Steelers and Ravens and Baltimore Positive.